functioning neocortex, the limbic system, could not produce visions with the clarity and logic I experienced. Could my experience have been a kind of psychedelic vision produced by some of the many drugs I was on? Again, all these drugs work with receptors in the neocortex, and with no neocortex functioning, there was no canvas for these drugs to work on. How about REM intrusion? This is the name of a syndrome related to rapid eye movement or REM sleep, the phase in which dreams occur, in which natural neurotransmitters, such as serotonin, interact with receptors in the neocortex. Sorry again. REM intrusion needs a functioning neocortex to happen, and I didn't have one. Then there was the hypothetical phenomenon known as DMT dump. In this situation, the pineal gland, reacting to the stress of a perceived threat to the brain, produces a substance called DMT, or N,N-dimethyltryptamine. DMT is structurally similar to serotonin and can bring on an extremely intense psychedelic state. I'd had no personal experience with DMT, and still haven't, but I have no argument with those who say it can produce a very powerful psychedelic experience, maybe one with genuine implications for our understanding of what consciousness and reality actually are. However, it remains a fact that the portion of the brain that DMT affects, the neocortex, was, in my case, not there to be affected. So in terms of explaining what happened to me, the DMT dump hypothesis came up as radically short as the other chief candidates for explanations of my experience, and for the same key reason. Hallucinogens affect the neocortex, and my neocortex wasn't available to be affected. The final hypothesis I looked at was that of the reboot phenomenon. This would explain my experience as an assembly of essentially disjointed memories and thoughts left over from before my cortex went completely down. Like a computer restarting and saving what it could after a system-wide failure, my brain would have pieced together my experiences from these leftover bits as best it could. This might occur on restarting the cortex into consciousness after a prolonged system-wide failure, as in my diffuse meningitis. But this seems most unlikely given the intricacies and interactivity of my elaborate recollections. Because I experienced the nonlinear nature of time in the spiritual world so intensely, I can now understand why so much writing on the spiritual dimension can seem distorted or simply nonsensical from our earthly perspective. In the worlds above this one, time simply doesn't behave as it does here. It's not necessarily one thing after another in those worlds. A moment can seem like a lifetime, and one or several lifetimes can seem like a moment. But though time doesn't behave ordinarily in our terms in the worlds beyond, that doesn't mean it's jumbled, and my own recollections from my time in coma were anything but. My most this-worldly anchors in my experience, temporally speaking, were my interactions with Susan Wrenches when she contacted me on my fourth and fifth nights, and the appearance toward the end of my journey of those six faces. Any other appearance of temporal simultaneity between events on Earth and my journey beyond it are, you might say, purely conjectural. The more I learned of my condition and the more I sought, using the current scientific literature, to explain what had happened, the more I came up spectacularly short. Everything, the uncanny clarity of my vision, the clearness of my thoughts as pure conceptual flow, suggested higher, not lower, brain functioning. But my higher brain had not been around to do that work. The more I read of the scientific explanations of what NDEs are, the more I was shocked by their transparent flimsiness. And yet I also knew with chagrin that they were exactly the ones that the old me would have pointed to vaguely if someone had asked me to explain what an NDE is. But people who weren't doctors couldn't be expected to know this. If what I'd undergone had happened to someone, anyone else, it would have been remarkable enough. But that it had happened to me, well, saying that it had happened for a reason made me feel a little uneasy. There was enough of the old doctor in me to know how outlandish, how grandiose, in fact, that sounded. but when I added up the sheer unlikelihood of all the details, and especially when I considered how precisely perfect a disease E. coli meningitis was for taking my cortex down and my rapid and complete recovery from almost certain destruction, I simply had to take seriously the possibility that it really and truly had happened for a reason. That only made me feel a greater sense of responsibility to tell my story right. I had always made it a point of pride to keep up on the latest medical literature in my field and to contribute as well when I had something of value to add. That I had been rocketed out of this world and into another one was news, genuine medical news, and now that I was back, I was not going to sell it short. Medically speaking, that I had recovered completely was a flat-out impossibility, a medical miracle. But the real story lay in where I had been, and I had a duty not just as a scientist and a profound respecter of the scientific method, but also as a healer to tell that story. A story, a true story, can heal as much as medicine can. Susanna had known that when she called me that day in my office, and I'd experienced as much myself when I'd heard back from my birth family. What had happened to me was healing news, too. What kind of a healer would I be if I didn't share it? A little over 2 years after returning from coma, I visited a close friend and colleague who chairs one of the foremost academic neuroscience departments in the world. I've known John, not his real name, for decades and consider him a wonderful human being and a first-rate scientist. I told John some of the story of my spiritual journey deep in coma, and he looked quite amazed. Not amazed at how crazy I now was, but as if he was finally making sense of something that had mystified him for a long time. It turned out that about a year earlier, John's father was nearing the end of a 5-year illness. He was incapacitated, demented, in pain, and wanted to die. "Please," his father had begged John from his deathbed, "give me some pills or something. I can't go on like this." Then suddenly his father became more cogent than he had been in 2 years as he discussed some deep observations about his life and about their family. He then shifted his gaze and began talking to the air at the foot of his bed. Listening, John realized that his father was talking to his deceased mother, who had died 65 years before when John's father was just a teenager. He had barely mentioned her during John's life, but now was having a joyous and animated discussion with her. John could not see her, but was absolutely convinced that her spirit was there, welcoming his father's spirit home. After a few minutes of this, John's father turned back to him, a completely different look in his eye. He was smiling, and clearly very much at peace, more than John could ever remember seeing in him before. "Go to sleep, Dad," John found himself saying. "Just let go. It's okay." His father did just that. Closing his eyes, he drifted off with a look of complete peace on his face. Shortly thereafter, he passed on. John felt the encounter between his father and his departed grandmother was very real, but he had not known what to do with it because, as a doctor, he knew such things were impossible. Many others have seen that astonishing clarity of mind that often comes to demented elderly people just before they pass on, just as John had seen in his father, a phenomenon known as terminal lucidity. There was no neuroscientific explanation for that. Hearing my story seemed to give him a license he had been longing for someone to give him, the license to believe what he had seen with his own eyes, to know that deep and comforting truth, that our eternal spiritual self is more real than anything we perceive in this physical realm and has a divine connection to the infinite love of the Creator. Chapter 32, A Visit to Church. There are only two ways to live your life. One is as though nothing is a miracle. The other is as if everything is. Albert Einstein, 1879 to 1955. I didn't make it back to church until December 2008, when Holly coaxed me out to services for the second Sunday of Advent. I was still weak, still a bit off balance, still underweight. Holly and I sat in the front row. Michael Sullivan was presiding over the service that day, and he came up and asked if I felt like lighting the second candle on the Advent wreath. I didn't want to, but something told me to do it anyhow. I stood up, put my hand on the brass pole, and strode to the front of the church with unexpected ease. My memory of my time out of the body was still naked and raw, and everywhere I turned in this place that had failed to move me much before, I saw art and heard music that brought it all right back. The pulsing bass note of a hymn echoed the rough misery of the realm of the earthworm's eye view. The stained glass windows with their clouds and angels brought to mind the celestial beauty of the gateway. A painting of Jesus breaking bread with his disciples evoked the communion of the core. I shuddered as I recalled the bliss of infinite, unconditional love I had known there. At last, I understood what religion was really all about, or at least was supposed to be about. I didn't just believe in God, I knew God. As I hobbled to the altar to take communion, tears streamed down my cheeks. Chapter 33, The Enigma of Consciousness. If you would be a real seeker after truth, it is necessary that at least once in your life you doubt, as far as possible, all things. René Descartes, 1596-1650. It took about 2 months for my full battery of neurosurgical knowledge to come back to me. Leaving aside for the moment the essentially miraculous fact that it did come back, there continues to be no medical precedent for my case, in which a brain under long-term attack of such a severe degree by gram-negative bacteria like E. coli recovers anything like its full abilities. Once it had, I continued to wrestle with the fact that everything I had learned in 4 decades of study and work about the human brain, about the universe, and about what constitutes reality conflicted with what I'd experienced during those 7 days in coma. When I fell into my coma, I was a secular doctor who had spent his entire career in some of the most prestigious research institutions in the world, trying to understand the connections between the human brain and consciousness. It wasn't that I didn't believe in consciousness. I was simply more aware than most people of the staggering mechanical unlikelihood that it existed independently at all. In the 1920s, the physicist Werner Heisenberg and other founders of the science of quantum mechanics made a discovery so strange that the world has yet to completely come to terms with it. When observing subatomic phenomena, it is impossible to completely separate the observer, that is, the scientist making the experiment, from what is being observed. In our day-to-day world, it is easy to miss this fact. We see the universe as a place full of separate objects, tables and chairs, people and planets, that occasionally interact with each other, but that nonetheless remain essentially separate. On the subatomic level, however, this universe of separate objects turns out to be a complete illusion. In the realm of the super small, every object in the physical universe is intimately connected with every other object. In fact, there are really no objects in the world at all, only vibrations of energy and relationships. What that meant should have been obvious, though it wasn't to many. It was impossible to pursue the core reality of the universe without using consciousness. Far from being an unimportant byproduct of physical processes, as I had thought before my experience, consciousness is not only very real, it's actually more real than the rest of physical existence, and most likely the basis of it all. But neither of these insights has yet been truly incorporated into science's picture of reality. Many scientists are trying to do so, but as of yet there is no unified theory of everything that can combine the laws of quantum mechanics with those of relativity theory in a way that begins to incorporate consciousness. All the objects in the physical universe are made up of atoms. Atoms, in turn, are made up of protons, electrons, and neutrons. These, in turn, are, as physicists also discovered in the early years of the 20th century, all particles. And particles are made up of, well, quite frankly, physicists don't really know. But one thing we do know about particles is that each one is connected to every other one in the universe. They are all, at the deepest level, interconnected. Before my experience out beyond, I was generally aware of all these modern scientific ideas, but they were distant and remote. In the world I lived and moved in, the world of cars and houses and operating tables and patients who did well or not, depending partially on whether I operated on them successfully, these facts of subatomic physics were rarefied and removed. They might be true, but they didn't concern my daily reality. But when I left my physical body behind, I experienced these facts directly. In fact, I feel confident in saying that, while I didn't even know the term at the time, while in the gateway and in the core, I was actually doing science. Science that relied on the truest and most sophisticated tool for scientific research that we possess. Consciousness itself. The further I dug, the more convinced I became that my discovery wasn't just interesting or dramatic. It was scientific. Depending on whom you talk to, consciousness is either the greatest mystery facing scientific inquiry or a total non-problem. What's surprising is just how many more scientists think it's the latter. For many, maybe most scientists, consciousness isn't really worth worrying about because it is just a byproduct of physical processes. Many scientists go further, saying that not only is consciousness a secondary phenomenon, but that, in addition, it's not even real. Many leaders in the neuroscience of consciousness and the philosophy of mind, however, would beg to differ. Over the last few decades, they have come to recognize the hard problem of consciousness. Although the idea had been coalescing for decades, it was David Chalmers who defined it in his brilliant 1996 book, The Conscious Mind. The hard problem concerns the very existence of conscious experience and can be distilled into these questions. How does consciousness arise out of the functioning of the human brain? How is it related to the behavior that it accompanies? How does the perceived world relate to the real world? The hard problem is so hard to resolve that some thinkers have said the answer lies outside of science altogether, but that it lies outside the bounds of current science in no way belittles the phenomenon of consciousness. In fact, it is a clue as to its unfathomably profound role in the universe. The ascendance of the scientific method based solely in the physical realm over the past 400 years presents a major problem. We have lost touch with a deep mystery at the center of existence, our consciousness. It was, under different names and expressed through different worldviews, something known well and held close by pre-modern religions, but it was lost to our secular Western culture as we became increasingly enamored with the power of modern science and technology. For all of the successes of Western civilization, the world has paid a dear price in terms of the most crucial component of existence, our human spirit, the shadow side of high technology, modern warfare and thoughtless homicide and suicide, urban blight, ecological mayhem, cataclysmic climate change, polarization of economic resources is bad enough. Much worse, our focus on exponential progress in science and technology has left many of us relatively bereft in the realm of meaning and joy, and of knowing how our lives fit into the grand scheme of existence for all eternity. Questions concerning the soul and afterlife, reincarnation, God, and heaven proved difficult to answer through conventional scientific means, which implied that they might not exist. Likewise, extended consciousness phenomena, such as remote viewing, extrasensory perception, psychokinesis, clairvoyance, telepathy, and precognition have seemed stubbornly resistant to comprehend through standard scientific investigations. Before my coma, I doubted their veracity, mainly because I had never experienced them at a deep level, and because they could not be readily explained by my simplistic scientific view of the world. Like many other scientific skeptics, I refused to even review the data relevant to the questions concerning these phenomena. I prejudged the data and those providing it because my limited perspective failed to provide the foggiest notion of how such things might actually happen. Those who assert that there is no evidence for phenomena indicative of extended consciousness, in spite of overwhelming evidence to the contrary, are willfully ignorant. They believe they know the truth without needing to look at the facts. For those still stuck in the trap of scientific skepticism, I recommend the book Irreducible Mind, Tortoise Psychology for the 21st Century, published in 2007. The evidence for out-of-body consciousness is well presented in this rigorous scientific analysis. Irreducible Mind is a landmark opus from a highly reputable group, the Division of Perceptual Studies, based at the University of Virginia. The authors provide an exhaustive review of the relevant data, and the conclusion is inescapable. These phenomena are real, and we must try to understand their nature if we want to comprehend the reality of our existence. We have been seduced into thinking that the scientific worldview is fast approaching a theory of everything, or TOE, which would not seem to leave much room for our soul or spirit or for heaven and God. My journey deep into coma, outside of this lowly physical realm and into the loftiest dwelling place of the Almighty Creator, revealed the indescribably immense chasm between our human knowledge and the awe-inspiring realm of God. Each one of us is more familiar with consciousness than we are with anything else, and yet we understand far more about the rest of the universe than we do about the mechanism of consciousness. It is so close to home that it is almost forever beyond our grasp. There is nothing about the physics of the material world, quarks, electrons, photons, atoms, etc., and specifically the intricate structure of the brain, that gives the slightest clue as to the mechanism of consciousness. In fact, the greatest clue to the reality of the spiritual realm is this profound mystery of our conscious existence. This is a far more mysterious revelation than physicists or neuroscientists have shown themselves capable of dealing with, and their failure to do so has left the intimate relationship between consciousness and quantum mechanics, and thus physical reality, obscured. To truly study the universe on a deep level, we must acknowledge the fundamental role of consciousness in painting reality. Experiments in quantum mechanics shocked those brilliant fathers of the field, many of whom, Werner Heisenberg, Wolfgang Pauli, Niels Bohr, Erwin Schrödinger, Sir James Jeans, to name a few, turned to the mystical worldview seeking answers. They realized it was impossible to separate the experimenter from the experiment, and to explain reality without consciousness. What I discovered out beyond is the indescribable immensity and complexity of the universe, and that consciousness is the basis of all that exists. I was so totally connected to it that there was often no real differentiation between me and the world I was moving through. If I had to summarize all this, I would say first that the universe is much larger than it appears to be if we only look at its immediately visible parts. This isn't much of a revolutionary insight, actually, as conventional science acknowledges that 96% of the universe is made up of dark matter and energy. What are these dark entities? 70% is dark energy, that most mysterious force discovered by astronomers in the mid-1990s, as they found incontrovertible proof based on type 1A supernovas that for the last 5 billion years, the universe has been falling up, that the expansion of all of space is accelerating. Another 26% is dark matter, the anomalous excess gravity revealed over the last few decades in the rotation of galaxies and galactic clusters. Explanations will be made, but the mysteries beyond will never end. No one yet knows. But what made my experience unusual was the jolting immediacy with which I experienced the basic role of consciousness, or spirit. It wasn't theory when I learned this up there, but a fact, overwhelming and immediate as a blast of Arctic air in the face. Second, we, each of us, are intricately, irremovably connected to the larger universe. It is our true home, and thinking that this physical world is all that matters is like shutting oneself up in a small closet and imagining that there is nothing else out beyond it. And third, the crucial power of belief in facilitating mind over matter. I was often bemused as a medical student over the confounding power of the placebo effect, that medical studies had to overcome the 30% or so benefit that was attributed to a patient's believing that he was receiving medicine that would help him, even if it was simply an inert substance. Instead of seeing the underlying power of belief and how it influenced our health, the medical profession saw the glass as half empty, that the placebo effect was an obstacle to the demonstration of a treatment. At the heart of the enigma of quantum mechanics lies the falsehood of our notion of locality in space and time. The rest of the universe, that is, the vast majority of it, isn't actually distant from us in space. Yes, physical space seems real, but it is limited as well. The entire length and height of the physical universe is as nothing to the spiritual realm from which it has risen, the realm of consciousness, which some might refer to as the life force. This other, vastly grander universe isn't far away at all. In fact, it's right here where I am, reading the sentence, and right there where you are, listening. It's not far away physically, but simply exists on a different frequency. It's right here, right now, but we're unaware of it because we are, for the most part, closed to those frequencies on which it manifests. We live in the dimensions of familiar space and time, hemmed in by the peculiar limitations of our sensory organs and by our perceptual scaling within the spectrum from subatomic quantum up through the entire universe. Those dimensions, while they have many things going for them, also shut us out from the other dimensions that exist as well. The ancient Greeks discovered all of this long ago, and I was only discovering for myself what they'd already hit upon. Like understands like. The universe is so constructed that to truly understand any part of its many dimensions and levels, you have to become a part of that dimension. Or, stated a little more accurately, you have to open yourself to an identity with that part of the universe that you already possess, but which you may not have been conscious of. The universe has no beginning or end, and God is entirely present within every particle of it. Much, in fact most, of what people have had to say about God and the higher spiritual worlds has involved bringing them down to our level, rather than elevating our perceptions up to theirs. We taint with our insufficient descriptions their truly awesome nature. But though it never began and will never end, the universe does have punctuation marks, the purpose of which is to bring beings into existence and allow them to participate in the glory of God. The Big Bang that created our universe was one of these creative punctuation marks. Om's view was from outside, encompassing all of Om's creation and beyond even my higher dimensional field of view. Here, to see was to know. There was no distinction between experiencing something and my understanding it. I was blind, but now I see. Now took on a new meaning as I understood just how blind to the full nature of the spiritual universe we are on Earth, especially people like I had been, who would believe that matter was the core reality, and that all else, thought, consciousness, ideas, emotions, spirit, were simply productions of it. This revelation inspired me greatly because it allowed me to see the staggering heights of communion and understanding that lie ahead for us all, when each of us leaves the limitations of our physical body and brain behind. Humor, irony, pathos, I had always thought these were qualities we humans developed to cope with this so often painful and unfair world. And they are. But in addition to being consolations, these qualities are recognitions, brief, flashing, but all important, of the fact that whatever our struggles and sufferings in the present world are, they can't truly touch the larger, eternal beings that we in truth are. Laughter and irony are at heart reminders that we are not prisoners in this world, but voyagers through it. Another aspect of the good news is that you don't have to almost die to glimpse behind the veil, but you must do the work. Learning about that realm from books and presentations is a start, but at the end of the day, we each have to go deep into our own consciousness through prayer or meditation to access these truths. Meditation comes in many different forms. The most useful for me since my coma has been that developed by Robert A. Monroe, founder of the Monroe Institute in Faber, Virginia. Their freedom from any dogmatic philosophy offers a distinct advantage. The only dogma associated with Monroe's system of meditative exercises is, I am more than my physical body. This simple acknowledgement has profound implications. Robert Monroe was a successful radio program producer in the 1950s in New York. In the process of investigating the use of audio recordings as a sleep learning technique, he began to have out-of-body experiences. His detailed research over more than four decades has resulted in a powerful system to enhance deep, conscious exploration based on an audio technology he developed known as HemiSync. HemiSync can heighten the selective awareness and performance through creation of a relaxed state. HemiSync offers much more than this, however. Enhanced states of consciousness allow access to alternate perceptual modes, including deep meditation and mystical states. HemiSync involves the physics of resonant entrainment of brainwaves, their relationship to the perceptual and behavioral psychology of consciousness, and to the fundamental physiology of the brain, mind, and consciousness. HemiSync uses specific patterns of stereo sound waves of slightly different frequencies in each ear to induce synchronized brainwave activity. These binaural beats are generated at a frequency that is the arithmetic difference between the two signal frequencies. By using an ancient but highly accurate timing system in the brainstem that normally enables localization of sound sources in the horizontal plane around the head, these binaural beats can entrain the adjacent reticular activating system, which provides steady timing signals to the thalamus and cortex, enabling consciousness. These signals generate brainwave synchrony in the range of 1 to 25 hertz, or cycles per second, including the crucial region below the normal threshold for human hearing, which is 20 hertz. This lowest range is associated with brainwaves in the delta, that is less than 4 hertz, normally found in deep, dreamless sleep, theta, 4 to 7 hertz, seen in deep meditation and relaxation, and in non-REM sleep, and alpha ranges, 7 to 13 hertz, characteristic of REM or dream sleep, drowsiness at the borders of sleep, and awakened relaxation. In my journey of understanding after my coma, HemiSync potentially offered a means of inactivating the filtering function of the physical brain by globally synchronizing my neocortical electrical activity, just as my meningitis might have done, to liberate my out-of-body consciousness. I believe HemiSync has enabled me to return to a realm similar to that which I visited deep in coma, but without having to be deathly ill. But just as in my dreams of flying as a child, this is very much a process of allowing the journey to unfold. If I try to force it, to overthink it, or embrace the process too much, it doesn't work. To use the word all-knowing feels inappropriate, because the awe and creative power I witnessed was beyond naming. I realized that the proscriptions of some religions against naming God or depicting divine prophets did indeed have an intuitive correctness to them, because God's reality is in truth so completely beyond any of our human attempts at capturing God in words or pictures while here on earth. Just as my awareness was both individual yet at the same time completely unified with the universe, so also did the boundaries of what I experienced as my self at times contract and at other times expand to include all that exists throughout eternity. The blurring of the boundary between my awareness and the realm around me went so far at times that I became the entire universe. Another way of putting this would be to say that I momentarily saw an identity with the universe which had been there all the time, but that I had just been blind to up till then. An analogy I often use to demonstrate my consciousness at that deepest level is that of a hen's egg. While in the core, even when I became one with the orb of light and the entire higher dimensional universe throughout all eternity, and was intimately one with God, I sensed strongly that the creative, primordial, prime mover aspect of God was the shell around the egg's contents, intimately associated throughout, as our consciousness is a direct extension of the divine, yet forever beyond the capability of absolute identification with the consciousness of the created. Even as my consciousness became identical with all and eternity, I sensed that I could not become entirely one with the creative, originating driver of all that is. At the heart of the most infinite oneness, there was still that duality. It is possible that such apparent duality is simply the result of trying to bring such awareness back into this realm. I never heard Om's voice directly, nor saw Om's face. It was as if Om spoke to me through thoughts that were like wave walls rolling through me, rocking everything around me, and showing that there is a deeper fabric of existence, a fabric that all of us are always part of, but which we're generally not conscious of. So I was communicating directly with God? Absolutely. Expressed that way, it sounds grandiose. But when it was happening, it didn't feel that way. Instead, I felt like I was doing what every soul is able to do when they leave their bodies, and what we can all do right now through various methods of prayer or deep meditation. Communicating with God is the most extraordinary experience imaginable, yet at the same time, it's the most natural one of all, because God is present in us at all times, omniscient, omnipotent, personal, and loving us without conditions. We are connected as one through our divine link with God. Chapter 34, A Final Dilemma. I must be willing to give up what I am in order to become what I will be. Albert Einstein, 1879-1955. Einstein was one of my early scientific idols. This quote of his had always been one of my favorites, but I now understood what those words actually meant. Crazy as I knew it sounded every time I told my story to one of my scientific colleagues, as I could see in their glazed or perturbed expressions, I knew I was telling them something that had genuine scientific validity, and that it opened the door to a whole new world, a whole new universe of scientific comprehension. Observation that honored consciousness itself as the single greatest entity in all of existence. But one common event in NDEs had not happened with me. Or, more accurately, there was a small group of experiences I had not undergone, and all of these clustered around one fact. While out, I had not remembered my earthly identity. Though no two NDEs are exactly alike, I discovered early on in my reading that there is a very consistent list of typical features that many contain. One of these is a meeting with one or more deceased people that the NDE subject had known in life. I had met no one I'd known in life. But that part didn't bother me so much, as I'd already discovered that my forgetting of my earthly identity had allowed me to move further in than many NDE subjects do. There was certainly nothing to complain about in that. What did bother me was that there was one person I would have deeply loved to have met. My dad had died 4 years before I entered coma. Given that he knew how I felt I had failed to measure up to his standards during those lost years of mine, why had he not been there to tell me it was okay? For comfort was indeed what the NDE subject's friends or family who greeted them were most often intent on conveying. I longed for that comfort, and yet I hadn't received it. It wasn't that I hadn't received any words of comfort at all, of course. I had, from the girl on the butterfly wing. But wonderful and angelic as this girl was, she was no one I knew. Having seen her every time I entered that idyllic valley on the wing of a butterfly, I remembered her face perfectly, so much so that I knew I had never met her in my life, at least my life on Earth. And in NDEs, it was often the meeting with a known earthly friend or relation that sealed the deal for the people who had undergone these experiences. Try as I did to brush it off, this fact introduced an element of doubt into my thoughts on what it all meant. It wasn't that I doubted what had happened to me. That was impossible, and I'd have just as soon doubted my marriage to Holly or my love for my kids. But the fact that I had traveled to the beyond without meeting my father and met my beautiful companion on the butterfly wing, whom I didn't know, still troubled me. Given the intensely emotional nature of my relationship to my family, my feelings of lack of worth because I had been given away, why hadn't that all-important message, that I was loved, that I would never be thrown away, been delivered by someone I knew, someone like my dad? For in fact, thrown away was, on a deep level, how I had indeed felt all through my life, in spite of all the best efforts of my family to heal that feeling through their love. My dad had often told me not to be overly concerned about whatever had happened to me before he and Mom had picked me up at the children's home. "You wouldn't remember anything that happened to you that early anyhow," he'd said. And in that, he'd been wrong. My NDE had convinced me that there is a secret part of ourselves that is recording every last aspect of our earthly lives, and that this recording process commences at the very, very beginning. So on a precognitive, preverbal level, I'd known all through my life that I'd been given away, and on a deep level I was still struggling to forgive that fact. As long as this question remained open, there would remain a dismissive voice, one that told me, insistently and even deviously, that for all the perfection and wonder of my NDE, something had been missing, had been off about it. In essence, a part of me still doubted the authenticity of my astonishingly real deep coma experience, and thus of the true existence of that entire realm. To that part of me, it continued to not make sense from a scientific standpoint. And that small but insistent voice of doubt began to threaten the whole new worldview I was slowly building. Chapter 35, The Photograph. Gratitude is not only the greatest of virtues, but the parent of all others. Cicero, 106-43 BCE. 4 months after my departure from the hospital, my birth family's sister, Kathy, finally got around to sending me a photo of my birth sister, Betsy. I was up in our bedroom, where my odyssey all began, when I opened the oversized envelope and pulled out a framed, glossy color photo of the sister I had never known. She was standing, I would later find out, near the docking pier of the Balboa Island Ferry, near her home in Southern California, a beautiful West Coast sunset in the background. She had long brown hair and deep blue eyes, and her smile, radiating love and kindness, seemed to go right through me, making my heart both swell and ache at the same time. Kathy had affixed a poem over the photo. It was written by David M. Romano in 1993 and was called When Tomorrow Starts Without Me. When tomorrow starts without me, and I'm not there to see, if the sun should rise and find your eyes all filled with tears for me, I wish so much you wouldn't cry the way you did today, while thinking of the many things we didn't get to say. I know how much you love me as much as I love you, and each time you think of me, I know you'll miss me too. But when tomorrow starts without me, please try to understand that an angel came and called my name and took me by the hand and said my place was ready in heaven far above and that I'd have to leave behind all those I dearly love. But as I turned to walk away, a tear fell from my eye. For all my life, I'd always thought I didn't want to die. I had so much to live for. So much left yet to do, it seemed almost impossible that I was leaving you. I thought of all the yesterdays, the good ones and the bad, the thought of all the love we shared and all the fun we had. If I could relive yesterday, just even for a while, I'd say goodbye and kiss you and maybe see you smile. But then I fully realized that this could never be. For emptiness and memories would take the place of me. And when I thought of worldly things I might miss come tomorrow, I thought of you, and when I did, my heart was filled with sorrow. But when I walked through heaven's gates, I felt so much at home. When God looked down and smiled at me from his great golden throne, he said, "This is eternity and all I've promised you. Today your life on earth is past, but here it starts anew. I promise no tomorrow, but today will always last. And since each day's the same way, there's no longing for the past. You have been so faithful, so trusting, and so true. Though there were times you did some things you knew you shouldn't do. But you have been forgiven, and now at last you're free. So won't you come and take my hand and share my life with me? So when tomorrow starts without me, don't think we're far apart. For every time you think of me, I'm right here in your heart." My eyes were misting as I put the picture carefully up on the dresser and continued to stare at it. She looked so strangely, hauntingly familiar. But of course she would look that way. We were blood relations and had shared more DNA than any other people on the planet, with the exception of my other two biological siblings. Whether we'd ever met or not, Betsy and I were deeply connected. The next morning, I was in our bedroom reading more of the Elizabeth Kubler-Ross book, On Life After Death, when I came to a story about a 12-year-old girl who underwent an NDE. And at first didn't tell her parents about it. Finally, however, she could no longer keep it to herself and confided in her father. She told him about traveling to an incredible landscape full of love and beauty and how she met and was comforted by her brother. "The only problem," the girl told her father, "is that I don't have a brother." Tears filled her father's eyes. He told the girl about the brother she did indeed have, but who had died just 3 months before she was born. I stopped reading. For a moment, I went into a strange, dazed space, not really thinking or not thinking, just absorbing something. Some thought that was right on the edge of my consciousness, but hadn't quite broken through. Then my eyes traveled over to the bureau, and the photo that Kathy had sent me, the photo of the sister I had never known, whom I knew only through the stories that my birth family had related of what a hugely kind, wonderfully caring person she had been. A person, they had often said, who was so kind she was practically an angel. Without the powder blue and indigo dress, without the heavenly light of the gateway around her as she sat on the beautiful butterfly wing, she wasn't easy to recognize at first, but but that was only natural. I had seen her heavenly self, the one that lived above and beyond this earthly realm with all its tragedies and cares. But now there was no mistaking her, no mistaking the loving smile, the confident and infinitely comforting look, the sparkling blue eyes. It was she. For an instant, the worlds met. My world here on Earth, where I was a doctor and father and a husband, and that world out there, a world so vast that as you journeyed in it, you could lose your very sense of your earthly self and become a pure part of the cosmos, the God-soaked and love-filled darkness. In that one moment, in the bedroom of our house, on a rainy Tuesday morning, the higher and the lower worlds met. Seeing that photo made me feel a little like the boy in the fairy tale who travels to the other world and then returns, only to find that it was all a dream. Until he looks in his pocket and finds a scintillating handful of magical earth from the realms beyond. As much as I tried to deny it, for weeks now a fight had been going on inside me. A fight between the part of my mind that had been out there beyond the body and the doctor, the healer who had pledged himself to science. I looked into the face of my sister, my angel, and I knew completely, that the two people I had been in the last few months, since coming back, were indeed one. I needed to completely embrace my role as a doctor, as a scientist and healer, and as the subject of a very unlikely, very real, very important journey into the divine itself. It was important not because of me, but because of the fantastically, deal-breakingly convincing details behind it. My NDE had healed my fragmented soul. It had let me know that I had always been loved, and it also showed me that absolutely everyone else in the universe is loved too. And it had done so while placing my physical body into a state that, by medical science's current terms, should have made it impossible for me to have experienced anything. I know there will be people who will seek to invalidate my experience anyhow, and many who will discount it out of court because of a refusal to believe that what I underwent could possibly be scientific, could possibly be anything more than a crazy, feverish dream. But I know better, and both for the sake of those here on Earth and those I met beyond this realm, I see it as my duty, both as a scientist and hence a seeker of truth, and as a doctor devoted to helping people, to make it known to as many people as I can that what I underwent is true and real and of stunning importance, not just to me, but to all of us. Not only was my journey about love, but it was also about who we are, and how connected we all are. The very meaning of all existence. I learned who I was up there, and when I came back, I realized that the last broken strands of who I am down here were sewn up. You are loved. Those words are what I needed to hear as an orphan, as a child who'd been given away. But it's also what every one of us in this materialistic age needs to hear as well. Because in terms of who we really are, where we really came from, and where we're really going, we all feel, wrongly, like orphans. Without recovering that memory of our larger connectedness and of the unconditional love of our Creator, we will always feel lost here on Earth. So here I am. I'm still a scientist, I'm still a doctor, and as such, I have two essential duties, to honor truth and to help heal. That means telling my story, a story that as time passes, I feel certain happened for a reason, not because I'm anyone special. It's just that with me, two events occurred in unison and concurrence, and together they break the back of the last efforts of reductive science to tell the world that the material realm is all that exists, and that consciousness, or spirit, yours and mine, is not the great and central mystery of the universe. I'm living proof. knew afterward. What if you slept? And what if, in your sleep, you went to heaven and there plucked a strange and beautiful flower? And what if, when you awoke, you had the flower in your hand? Ah, what then? Samuel Taylor Coleridge. How do you tell people they're living in a new world? That was my challenge 5 years ago when I first put pen to paper. It's still my challenge now. Since Proof of Heaven was published, most of my time has been taken up with telling my story. I've spoken to thousands of people in the past several months, and the joy I get from sharing my essential message that each of us is immortal, that consciousness is not contained or limited by the brain, that death is not the end, and that love is the most powerful force in the universe, is such that I simply never tire of telling it. But no matter how many times I tell it, I never get it quite right. I can't, because all I've got is words. And trying to describe the world beyond this one with earthly words alone is like trying to draw an intricate color portrait with a single dull pencil nub. It is, to say the least, frustrating. And yet, through that very failure to convey what happened to me as vividly as I would like to, I've learned something important. Something that has to do, precisely, with words. In the original proof, I used a lot of words I've been criticized for. If Dr. Alexander is a Christian, people asked, why wasn't the word God good enough for him? Likewise, with the word I used for the presence that followed me past the gateway and deep into the core. Orb. Didn't I understand how crazy, how science fiction-like this word sounded? Yes, I did. And yes, I still do. But orb was, and still is, the closest and simplest word I could find to describe what that warm, living, fully intelligent, fully compassionate being was. Though I very much felt that the being who communicated to me as Om was God, the word God fell short for me. As an American growing up in the South in the 20th century, the word I'm used to hearing and saying is God. Om is not, and yet when I heard it up there, it was deeply familiar. Though I knew in my heart that the being which communicated with me and guided me was God, I also feared that the word could be used to exclude and misinform. According to Hinduism, Om, or A-U-M, as it's sometimes spelled, is the primordial syllable. It both is God, and at the same time is the primal word uttered by God when the universe was created. This is strangely close to what the Gospel of John suggests in its first lines. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. Similarly, in the Hebrew Bible, God, hovering over the face of the primordial waters, the tohu wevohu of chaos, changed that chaos to order with the words, "Let there be light." God, here, literally speaks the order of the world, what the New Testament calls its logos, into being. Words, for the writers of these texts, both describe and are the very root of the world and the supreme mystery of its creation. They are, really and truly, magical. But words also get used, and the more they get used, the less power they carry. The weight of the sacred gets drained away from them. So it was that words, in their ability to be both completely fresh or completely stale, showed me the key issue I would face in bringing my story back. How to keep it completely fresh, while using words to tell it. The more people read my story, the more familiar the concepts and experiences in it become, the more it threatens to lose the charge it started out with and become just another near-death story. I don't want that to happen. What happened to me was shocking. It was life-changing. To me, it feels as new today as when it happened. It has, to quote the poet Wordsworth, the glory and the freshness of a dream. Except, of course, that it wasn't a dream. But how to give that feeling to others and to help them keep it? Pull a fish from the water. Cut a flower and leave it on a table for the night. What happens? The colors fade. The life retreats. Where does it go? Materialists would say it simply vanishes, but it doesn't. It returns to where it came from. the realm above our world of matter, the place where we, each of us, came from and where we will return as well. My story was and remains a medical miracle. In the year since Proof of Heaven came out, no one has